what we'll end up with at the end of this year in 2022 is a network that's settling trillions of dollars of economic value, that's creating opportunity, creating jobs around the world, enabling innovation, and it will be zero carbon.
Hello, and welcome to Identity Today, your go-to for what's what and all things security, digital identity, and biometric tech. I'm your host, Blair Crawford. Today on the show, I'm joined by Joshua Doner, growth partner at TracerDAO, advisor at tokens.com, and one of the first people in the world to buy an NFT. The topic of focus today is digital assets. I really hope you enjoy the chat.
I think it might be worthwhile to take 1 minute to discuss security.
Welcome to the episode, Joshua. Great to have you on today.
Likewise, Blair. Let's do it.
Let's set the scene. Tell us a bit about yourself. Who are you and what are you into right now? I can see all these CryptoPunks in the background.
Yeah, crazy avatars, aren't they? My name's Josh. I am from Toronto. I am one of the first 30 to 60 wallets to ever buy an NFT on Ethereum back in 2017 in June there. I started owning and buying CryptoPunks. I've been in crypto for a long time. Today, I work on TracerDAO, which is a derivative protocol on Arbitrum that allows anyone to get exposure to any markets with any collateral. I'm really excited about that product, as well as I work as an advisor to tokens.com, which is Canada's largest public company that focuses on metaverse, DeFi, and staking protocols.
Let's go to the origin story then on a couple of things you touched on there. You know, CryptoPunks weren't one of the first 30 to 60 wallets, as you said. How did it all come about?
Yeah, really, really small community back then in June 2017. So a little backstory, a group called Larva Labs ran by Matt and John. They work actually at Google Labs as well. So they're part of Google's kind of innovation side. They are known for creating the Android avatar. So if you go open your Android phone, you see the little green Android dude. They were the inspiration behind that aesthetic. And so in June 2017, Matt and John wrote their first smart contract, and which now became the smart contract powering CryptoPunks. And they put it out on the internet via Reddit blog posts. And at first, this collection of 10,000 collectible algorithmically generated characters was able to be claimed for free. And so you would come, you take the smart contract, you would ingest it into your full Ethereum node Mist wallet. Then you could interact with the smart contract functions, you could claim your CryptoPunks, and then they would be sitting in your wallet. And so that's kind of how the early days of CryptoPunks got started.
It sounds complicated. A lot of people even now buying NFTs, and we're going to go into a little bit about the technology in a second. Things have evolved, but it still is quite complex a concept for people to get their heads around and what it's all about. So I want to dig into that for a little bit. What is an NFT? Can you unpack some of the technology we're talking about here when you refer to CryptoPunks as an example?
Yeah, so fungible tokens have been known as like Bitcoin or Ethereum. That's the underlying technology that enables these token systems to work, which is on the blockchain, the Ethereum blockchain or Bitcoin's blockchain or any other number of many, many other blockchains. The non-fungible part is this concept that not every token is the same. So a great example of this, if you had a stack of $100 bills and you added in another $100 bill to that stack and you pulled a $100 bill out, it wouldn't matter because they're all worth the same amount. Whereas if you had a stack of Pokemon cards and you added a Charizard to that stack, you know, you would want to get a Pikachu or a equivalent rarity Pokemon back, or else, you know, you would lose value on that trade. So non-fungible tokens is this concept of each individual token is actually a unique asset. And that could be both a physical world asset like real estate or different investment contracts, or it could be a digital asset like a collectible like CryptoPunks, Bored Apes, or Cool Cats.
I mean, where are we today in terms of the technology? Is it advanced or is it with the early days? What's your perspective?
Yeah, I think we're at the early stage of NFTs being used for things in supply chain and real estate and all sorts of different applications. How it started, though, was from digital collectibles. And like anything in the crypto world, you know, why didn't blockchains for supply chains take off? Well, it's most likely because the killer use case was securing digital assets. With NFTs, the killer use case is securing a unique digital asset. And what great way to represent that as digital media. And so we look at, you know, how many people like Bitcoin videos versus who like cool cat videos on YouTube, or who like the overly attached girlfriend meme and share that on Twitter, or the video, the iconic Charlie bit my finger video that is the first viral video on YouTube. I mean, those are unique digital properties that can be tokenized as an NFT and be tradable. And so everyone can enjoy it for free. That's, you know, one of the things NFT solve for in the early internet is you can enjoy the content for free versus, you know, if you remember back to LimeWire or a BearShare, some of these downloading platforms, like those creators got nothing out of that. In this new world, that digital media, the ownership receipt can be tokenized and can be traded, can be fractionalized, it can be turned into a financial product that then has the ability to have free market discovery. And so that's kind of, you know, a big innovation to the internet.
You just you touched on the opportunity for creators to be able to be remunerated and enjoy the outcome of some of the things which they've actually produced to be shared with the wider internet, for example. But I want to touch on, you know, when we started chatting, you rhymed off to me a very interesting stat, and it felt big at the time. And it was about the economic opportunity that NFTs and the larger digital asset market presented. You said that $11 trillion of transactions were settled on Ethereum, I think you said last year. And that's five times the size of the Canadian economy. Can you expand from your perspective? What is the overarching economic opportunity that this, whatever it is that's happening right now, is presenting to us?
Yeah, there's a large cohort of economists and the IMF and large government agencies that just don't believe crypto is valuable. And I fundamentally disagree with that perspective. As Blair said, $11 trillion of transactions were settled on Ethereum in 2021. And that network is going through an upgrade process right now to go from proof of work, which is using a mining algorithm, which is energy intensive, to something called proof of stake, where there's 200,000 trusted validators in the world that are running essentially household computers. And so what that'll do is reduce the energy consumption of the network by 99%. And so what we'll end up with at the end of this year in 2022 is a network that's settling trillions of dollars of economic value, that's creating opportunity, creating jobs around the world, enabling innovation, and it will be zero carbon. And so I think that's a really important thing for policymakers to understand, is we have this really important opportunity here that to enable our economies to scale, double in size, triple in size, trillions of dollars into the metaverse, and it not cost any incremental carbon. And I think that will unlock a ton of economic opportunity, especially for people in emerging markets and around the world where they don't have necessarily a sophisticated economy like in the Western world.
What do you think is required from an economic policy perspective over the next few years to enable and support that?
Yeah, I think a generational shift is happening. Young people are becoming political leaders in El Salvador. The president there is about 40 years old. There's a young politician also in another Latin American country, I think Paraguay or Argentina. But I think young people are now entering into political positions. And we grew up with Pokemon. We grew up playing Nintendo 64 and in the internet in the early days of MSN. And we grew up with these things. And I think our generation is building an economic system that, you know, serves our values and interests, digital scarcity, things that are audible and transparent, the decentralization of power, the ability for anyone to have access to investment opportunities, you know, that are kind of crowdfunded. You know, we believe in these things. We believe also that just because you're an accredited investor, you're a wealthy individual, you know, you shouldn't have any better access to investment opportunities than someone, you know, who's starting out, coming out of college, who's educated. So, you know, I just think our generation has belief system that aligns with these crypto technologies. And I think as we become older and be in political leadership, we are going to build kind of the economy we want to see.
I suppose one of the easiest things, or the easier things to wrap the head around with regards to NFTs and digital assets or unique digital assets, is the idea of their rarity and uniqueness and the application of our traditional concepts around art and owning that art. So your CryptoPunks is a unique one of that. It's quite easy to understand the concept around how to assign value to it. I think what is interesting, though, is this idea of creating digital land on Decentraland, for example, or on Sandbox. What are your thoughts on digital land? Because theoretically, you could keep expanding digital land, which actually diminishes the value if you just keep adding on to it. It doesn't seem finite. But it seems like adoption of a particular type of land is key to the value of it. What are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, the expansion of digital metaverses will happen. So there's no argument there. I think what is powerful and how we think about the metaverse at tokens.com, which we own 70% of Metaverse Group, so we're one of the largest landholders in vertically integrated metaverse real estate companies. How we look at this is Decentraland is like a monopoly board. And so on the monopoly board, you have only a finite amount of spaces and places where you can build and add homes and upgrade to hotels and create different experiences that once players come and land on your space, they have to pay you rent. And so that's kind of what brands are doing today. And so as this monopoly board, it's going to always stay the same, but the amount of players is going from a few thousand people to, you know, we're launching a fashion week in March here with Playboy and a number of other large brands, and we're expecting 500,000 people to come through this world. And so as you get more people coming through these spaces, more e-commerce happening in these spaces, the value of the land within them and the utility available will increase in value. And so there may be more worlds, but adoption of those worlds is still up for debate. You know, what worlds are going to be adopted? So far, it's the market leaders like Sandbox, CryptoVoxels, Decentraland, and a few others.
Is it kind of like back in the day, Blu-ray versus HD DVD? You know, only one will survive. Well, maybe a few of them will survive.
Not necessarily. I kind of look at it like Web2 social media. So as people get onto Snapchat, you know, Snapchat's only as good as your friends that are on it. And so it's the same kind of concept, is these metaverse spaces will only be super valuable so long that people choose to spend time there and, you know, make purchases there or hang out there.
So one of the things that I want to touch on while we're on this in this chat is the security. And there's a lot of, I mean, if you look at the Discord community, it is for every second message, there's always almost a warning about scamming, watching out, especially during the minting of NFTs. What are your thoughts about the security posture of the industry right now, both in terms of its current state, but also in terms of what needs to happen in order to protect the users, which will ultimately fuel the growth and adoption of the industry?
Yeah, I mean, cybersecurity is a tough approach, because as so long as there's an economic incentive that is more than the effort put in to, you know, have a certain outcome, you will have security vulnerabilities. And so in crypto, you have a massive financial incentive for people to go and exploit those systems. It's important to understand two things. So on the blockchain base layer side, you know, Bitcoin's never been compromised. We're 10 years later and it's still worth a lot of money, almost $1 trillion. Same thing with Ethereum, it's worth $500 billion. So the base technology of the blockchain cannot be broken, and there's been a huge financial incentive to do so. And many people have tried. What often is compromised is what holds these assets. So the things like wallets, and really what people are, you know, scammers are doing is they're phishing for people's private keys. They're trying to coerce them into showing their private key. Maybe they click a bad link, connect their wallet to something that is a phishing site. So overall, the posture is not great. And where these funds are going, they've been traced back to countries that probably America and some other countries don't want those funds to go to. And so there's a financial incentive to do so. So I think from the industry, like, we need government to regulate this space, to take this extremely seriously, because it is a national security concern. And funny, from our pre chat last week, Joe Biden now has come out and said, hey, I'm going to do an executive order to regulate this space because it is a national security problem. You know, I think as an industry, we want to see common sense, good regulation that allows for innovation thriving, but also to protect consumers.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about your thoughts on that since our last chat, and the national security topic came up when we were talking. And as you said, President Biden since then has put that executive order through, or is due to, did it pass already or has it come through?
It's coming in February at some point here.
That seems to have moved very quickly, almost from a state of no real conversation to this is happening. Do you think there's anything happened in the world specifically which has spurred along the momentum of that?
Yeah, well, you know, Russia's come out over the weekend. Initially, they were going to ban crypto altogether. The central bank there was trying to push a legislation to ban it in Russia. And all of a sudden, Vladimir Putin said, you know, no, we actually need to embrace mining and the potential to use our excess energy for this reason. And so I think, you know, if you, as you see countries around the world adopt this, both at a government level, not only their citizens and constituents, but at a state level, like, you know, you have to do something. So it's about time. I've been in this industry for 6 years and no meaningful regulation has come down that has enabled innovation, but also kind of, you know, tried to bring the crypto industry into a regulatory framework. So it is about time.
I absolutely agree. And I think the regulation is the way to fuel the growth and adoption and to also protect the end users. I mean, you as an end user owning CryptoPunks, as we can see there in the background, how do you, without giving away the details, but how do you feel, or how have your feelings evolved as the value of those assets over time have started to get traction? Is it different steps? How do we educate users to say, hey, you got to watch this?
Yeah, I mean, you got to be very careful. As these assets go up in value, there is definitely your cyber kind of like online security. Obviously, I don't want to get phished or anything like that. So I'm very cognizant of not clicking links and being very specific who I communicate with and who I trust online. Then there's also the physical security element. In certain countries, people have been known to be held captive to force the movement of their coins to someone else, or even people have gotten arrested. And so they know the private key in their mind and their brain, and they're not sharing that with the police or whatnot. So, security is something that needs to be taken seriously. It's very difficult. And so my concept around this is I want to encourage the national banks of certain countries in Canada. We have a great financial system. But they aren't taking this seriously, which is a huge miss, in my opinion, because they are responsible for holding Canadian wealth. And it's very much within their remit to create a crypto custody solution to make sure Canadian wealth is not leaving the country and going to other parts of the world because people are clicking links on Discord. Like, this to me is just common sense and it should be adopted. So I'm not anti-bank. I think banks have an important role. And I think our industry is many trillions of dollars larger with financial institutions creating products and helping our grandmothers or our parents figure out how to use these assets.
So I've got a couple of other questions for you. The first one is, there seems to be, and it's pointing to some more recent news around both Meta and Twitter allowing the integration of people's own digital assets as their profile pictures. And it's an interesting interplay between identity and collectibles for a wealth creation reason, arguably. And that's probably subjective depending on what lens you look through. What is your thoughts on this overlay between digital identity and how people are representing themselves, but also, the kind of status that people are showing by certain assets which they present forward as part of their identity?
Yeah, I mean, it's human nature to want to show either you're successful or, you are unique. People dress a certain way because it shows a bit about who they are and their identity. And so that doesn't end when you go online. Gamers have been doing this for years, having skins and whatnot. You know, why do people own Rolexes? Why do people own Lamborghinis? Like, a Toyota Corolla will get you from A to B just fine. But when you show up with a Lambo, it says like, yo, I at least got 250, 300K in the bank for that, right? Like, and so the CryptoPunks and, you know, Bored Apes, what we're seeing, Justin Bieber bought a floor Bored Ape for 500 Ether over the weekend, and everyone's going crazy. Like, why would Justin Bieber buy a Bored Ape for 500 Ether? Well, he's got money. You know, that's what he wants to do to flex. And he wants to join the community. It's an exclusive club. And so that's, you know, we're seeing a lot of that digital flexes online. And this is never possible before. And the reason is because the IP, the underlying property there was never an asset. It was always just a JPEG that you could copy and paste. You can still copy and paste NFTs. Like I mentioned earlier in the show, you know, it solves for a lot of the copy and paste issue because the ownership receipt still trades somewhere. So yeah, the digital flexing, I think, isn't going to go anywhere. And it's Snoop Dogg, Jay-Z, Jason Derulo. And as these avatars get out in the world, so CryptoPunks, they're one of a 10,000 collection. Well, Jason Derulo reaches 300 million people. So now 300 million people know what CryptoPunks are because they see his avatar. So it's kind of like if you had 10,000 versions of a Nike logo. And so it's great when I see these celebrities flexing it because it raises the valuation of my own collection.
So to wrap up, and you pick the timeline here, where does it all end up?
I think crypto is the greatest opportunity of our generation. The world has been ran by other generations during the, you know, Great World Wars and throughout the era of the 60s and 70s, different cultural movements. And so it's time for our generation to build an economy that we believe in, and that's what we're doing. And so I think the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to see an explosion of value into the space. ARK Invest is predicting that Ethereum will be a $20 trillion market cap in the next 5 to 10 years. That I don't even know what that puts Ether's price at because I've never calculated it, but I can tell you it is huge. Like Bitcoin, they estimate at $20 to $100 trillion. And so you're seeing this massive value creation. And I'm not just talking about, like, you know, a certain stock or a certain asset within the index. I'm talking about the whole space is going to grow that big. And so that means that within it, there'll be tons of opportunity to create wealth and invest in things. And none of this is financial advice, of course, but there'll be a great opportunity for people building on top of that. You know, the analogy that a rising tide raises all boats, that analogy fits with crypto. And so today we're seeing engineers leave Google who are leaving financial institutions to work in Web3. And I just think that accelerates. It's very exciting.
I'm going to add on one more question then.
Hit me. Sorry, Blair.
Non-financial advice, as you said, what are your favorite projects right now, emerging or just established?
Yeah, I mean, my meta thesis here for, let's say, NFTs is that there's going to be a lot of DeFi NFT crossover. And so you'll see financial products, whether it be lending, derivatives, or kind of just yield products for NFTs themselves. It'll start with things like CryptoPunks and Bored Apes and those kind of really popular projects. And then it will move on to other NFTs. The other big thesis I have around NFTs, specifically with gaming, is that consumers are now voting with their wallets what IP that they want to see. And so if you're Pokemon, you have to be looking at this kind of seriously because maybe the next Pokemon isn't coming from Nintendo. It might be coming from a community that says, hey, we're financially incentivized to find the best IP, to create the best community. And so what the game makers might create is the framework, the economics, the kind of user or player experience of the game, but you'll connect your wallet and you'll bring your IP with you. And if you don't hold NFTs, what it might allow NFT owners to do is to then share their version of the game so their audience and their community can play with their Cool Cat or with their CryptoPunk or with their Bored Ape. And I think that will be really, really fascinating. On the play to earn side, you know, we're seeing games like Axie Infinity create financial opportunities for people in emerging markets. That definitely is going to be a space that continues to grow. And it will definitely give Facebook and Google and these centralized app stores and communities a bit of a run for their money because we're going to see a lot more connect your wallet to things. And that's going to be exciting.
Awesome to have you on. I am sure you will be back on to expand on some of this stuff. There's going to be lots of questions off the back of it. We'll speak to you soon. Thanks very much, Joshua.
Thanks, Blair.
That's all we have time for this week on Identity Today with me, Blair Crawford. I'd like to say a big thank you to our guest, Joshua, as well as a big thank you to you, our listeners. If you want to know more about what we do at Daltrey, go to daltrey.com.